I'm going to say manages to avoid being both obvious and obviously wrong. And if I'm saying things that you all know, forgive me. Blame it all on David. He told me try to avoid being technical. It's a highly intelligent audience, but you can't assume they know too much economics. So if at times you feel like getting up and telling me, really, we know that, tell it to David. When economists talk about inequality, usually what they have in mind, most of the time, is a discussion of what we call the size distribution of income. That is, the statistics that describe what percentage of the national income in a given year is received by the 1% of the highest income receivers, or the 1%, or the 5% of the lowest income receivers, and so on. And these figures are usually taken to be an indicator of what loosely let me call the rich-poor polarity in our society. As the figures go, they are as accurate as numbers are going to be on this subject. That isn't to say they are not what they are, without error, without flaw, but I don't think anyone who has ever dealt with them seriously feels they are dishonest or feels that one could do very much better. Consequently, when you talk about the statistics of income distribution, these are about as good a set of numbers as you're going to come by. However, as an indicator of rich-poor polarity, they are very, very defective. Let me indicate why. When you read, though, the tables from which these figures are derived, it should always be noted that they are figures referring to the distribution of income in a given year, say 1969, 1947, or whatever. Now, a very important source of inequality in the distribution of income in any year is the fact that people are at different stages in their different phases of their life cycle of earnings and of income receipts. In general, one of the things we are really most firm in, we feel we know most about, is that people, when they start earning, earn relatively low incomes. They reach a peak of their earnings sometime, depending on their schooling, between the ages of 35 and 54. And then in later years, their earnings tail off again. Roughly, and I say this very roughly, about 50% of the inequality that you hear people talk about in the distribution of income in any one year can be explained as due to differences in the earnings of people at different stages in their life earnings cycle. Let me put it in a very sharp form. If every person received the same lifetime income, we would say, I think, that this was as egalitarian a society as one could imagine. Yet every person could get the same lifetime earnings, the same lifetime income, get the same income at a given year in his life as everyone else did. For example, all 21-year-olds got exactly the same income. All 35-year-olds got the same income, and so on. And the distribution of income could be as unequal as the laws of arithmetic would permit. The 35-year-olds could be getting 1,000 or 1,000,000 times what the 21-year-olds were getting, or getting the same amount as the case may be. And the distribution of income in a given year would still reflect these vast inequalities that simply reflected the fact that people are at different stages in their earnings, in their life earning cycle. The reason for stressing this rather obvious point is that almost all the political debate you hear about inequality in the distribution of income is debate about how the income of the country is distributed in 1 year, without attempting to correct for the fact that much of this inequality is due to the fact that people are at different stages in their life earning cycle. By the same argument, changes in the inequality in the distribution of income may reflect something other than changes, and in fact do reflect something other than changes in rich-poor polarity. They reflect, for example, the fact that since 1945 there's been a tendency for older people living on retired incomes to separate from the high-earning prime-age children and set up their own households, get recorded in the income statistics as separate families with very low incomes. Similarly, because we are getting richer, not poorer, young people who are able to leave home at an earlier age than was the case two generations ago or a generation ago are recorded as separate families, also with low incomes. The purpose of these rather negative remarks at the outset is to explain why I'm not going to spend very much time talking about what economists usually talk about when they discuss the inequality in the distribution of income, namely the distribution of annual income of incomes in a given year. It's a very uncertain indicator of how much inequality there is in the community. It is essentially a political football which can be kicked around as people like to indicate that income is distributed not sufficiently equally or too unequally or it's changing in the wrong way, all of which is of, I won't say it's meaningless, but it's of darned uncertain meaning. And I would urge as one economist to economists and non-economists alike, don't try to make any capital out of what those figures show. They are complicated and tricky. They are not meaningless, but what they are usually taken to mean is simply not what they do mean. Now, one of the things one can say about the distribution of income, the size distribution of income, is that in general, the more schooling you get, the higher in the income distribution you are. The later you enter the labor force, the higher the wage at which you first start. The more schooling, and hence the later the entry date into the labor force, the faster your income rises once you get in. The later it peaks, the more it rises from the beginning to the end, from the beginning of your life earning cycle to the peak years. These are the sorts of propositions that one can make about the size distribution of income, and are the subject of a great deal of very careful and meticulous research that's now going on at the National Bureau. The first publication of this is in a monograph by my colleague Jacob Mincer called, let me read you the title, give it a proper plug, Schooling Age and Earnings. It will be out soon. I don't recommend it as light reading, but it's good, and it's a very healthy antidote to arguments about what's happening to the distribution of income or earnings insofar as this is supposed to indicate that the poor are getting poorer or the rich are getting richer or the reverse. Now, with these brief negative remarks out of the way, let me turn to some more positive remarks concerning inequality and what it is that might be done about it, or whether anything ought to be done about it at all. The basic reason why people are concerned with economic inequality is that in some sense there's a widespread feeling, it's deep, It is not consistent over time, but it certainly is recurrent, that in some sense or other, people with low incomes are the victims of an unfair game, I think it is not unreasonable to say that there is an important current of opinion in Western society that feels that in some sense economic life ought to be a game, and a game in which everybody more or less has a fair chance. And a fair chance, I think, roughly could be interpreted as having an equal opportunity. An equal opportunity to earn. Well, let's examine what that might mean. The first place, I think we have to distinguish between capacity and opportunity. And this is not an easy thing to do in the real world. In an hypothetical game situation, it's not hard to distinguish. The distinction is not hard to make. I have an equal opportunity to enter a golf tournament of amateurs, in any case, with practically anyone else, provided I'm willing to pay the entry fees, at least for many tournaments. But I certainly don't have an equal chance of winning. There is a little matter of capacity. In a situation like that, one can distinguish between capacity and opportunity fairly simply. The distinction is reflected in the fact that golfers are different golfers are given handicaps to try to make the game more nearly equal. But now, in what sense can we treat economic activity as a game in which opportunity ought to be equal? The first question we have to ask is, equal opportunity at what age? The age which you enter the labor force, at 18 or 22? Well, that's hopeless. That really is unfair. By the time you're 18 or 22, there are enormous built-in differences in capacity. And as we have heard for the last 10 to 15 years, the whole organization of society guarantees that there shall be inequality of capacity because of previous inequalities of opportunity to acquire capacity. Because capacity is acquired through schooling, home environment, and the like. Well, 18 or 22 is too early, push it back to 10. The differences in capacity are already built in. 6. Well, the same thing applies. You can give children at the age of 6 equal opportunity at schooling, but they don't have equal capacity to grasp it. To what does that do? Previous training? Take it back to the moment of birth, and there are still further difficulties, partly genetic, although I would urge that we don't leap to the conclusion that inequalities in capacity at birth be ascribed to genes. They may be due to some unknown, at present at least, unknown differences in prenatal environment. But whatever they are due to, it is clear that at very early ages, like 2 minutes, there are considerable differences in people's ability to utilize their environment effectively. And those differences tend to accumulate. They accumulate in ways that we're all familiar with and make the question of what would be meant by equal opportunity a terribly difficult one. That is equal opportunity in the sense of there being equal opportunity that is distinct from equal capacity. Now this is gradually beginning to be rather widely realized, even among people that are terribly concerned with getting equal opportunity. And it leads to demands not merely that opportunity be equal, but that we do something or other to ensure that capacities be made equal by various kinds of compensatory activities. Usually this involves a fair amount of activity by the government, and the further we move in this direction, the more clear it becomes that you have to get into the guts of family organization. When I was a student at the University of Chicago, Frank Knight used to say, you're never going to get anywhere achieving equality until you do something about the family. And he added, nobody wants to do anything about that. Well, that was 30 years ago. Now there are people who are very anxious to do something about the family. When this is done on an individualistic basis, a free society, indeed, I think, requires that they be permitted to live, to organize units for raising children in ways that are compatible with their individual tastes, or in accordance with their individual tastes. When we have social objectives to create equality, then indeed 1984 is not very far away from us. However, let me point out that the idea, the basic point I'm trying to make here, is that the notion of a fair contest as equality of opportunity is difficult to implement because of differences in capacity that appear really before birth. The fundamental difficulty is that God does not seem to have been an equal opportunity creator. And because of this, there is a fundamental conflict between a society in which people are to be free to use what capacities they have, however acquired, and attempt at any stage of life to achieve equal opportunity. This is not, by the way, an attempt to say equal opportunity is a bad goal or a wrong goal. It's to say it is a terribly difficult goal. And in particular, it is a goal that is likely to be in serious conflict with personal freedom when opportunity and capacity interact the way they do. The distinction between equality of opportunity and equality of capacity in the real world is a very difficult one to make. It's an artificial distinction that you make in the context of a game. And life as we know it is not that kind of a game. Now, despite what I've said, I suppose none of you are so naive as to imagine that there is going to be that realization of the point of my remarks is going to, in any sense, silence or reduce the political pressure for attempts to achieve equality, either of opportunity or of reward. This takes many forms, and certainly this afternoon I can only discuss one or two of them. The most obvious is income taxation, particularly progressive income taxation, but the progressiveness is not really essential. It is simply taxing in accordance with the principle of ability to pay, a principle that is so deeply ingrained in popular ideology that in public life it is, I think, politically counterproductive to challenge it. And I think you'll find very few people challenging it. Now, in discussing a taxation based on ability to pay, it's important to draw the distinction between a tax on capacity, either human or property, and a taxation upon the utilization of capacity. A tax on capacity, when you can levy it in practice, is a tax that you can't avoid. And what's more important, it's a tax that isn't going to cause resources to be wasted in trying to avoid it, and is, in that sense, a tax that is compatible with economic efficiency. How can you have a tax levied that is on capacity alone? Well, let me describe what one would look like. It would be a tax that would be assessed upon a person in the style of under the old regime in France, which the tax collector took a look at you and said, "Your bill is so much." And there was no way in which you could even predict how he would do it. So there was no point in trying to avoid the tax, and trying to be poor and trying not to work to avoid the tax. It was simply a head tax, poll tax. Such a tax would not discourage effort, because whatever you made over and above the tax, you could keep 100 cents on the dollar. And by the same token, inability to pay would be no excuse. If inability to pay is accepted as the basis for forgiveness, it's no longer a tax on capacity. Obviously, taxes of this kind aren't going to be levied. And it's perfectly clear they never could be. Taxes have got to be, in practice, one way or another, taxes that fall at least partly on the utilization of capacity. And when you tax on the basis of utilization of capacity, you discourage the utilization of it. Now, in particular, let me discuss the prime example of a tax that is supposed to be a tax on ability to pay, the income tax. Obviously, the tax, to some extent, discourages attempts to earn taxable income. I don't have to tell you how the lengths to which people will go, and do go, to avoid, or rather to reclassify, their earnings on their property income as non-taxable. Indeed, the complaints about millionaires who are escaping their fair share of taxes are very, very largely miss the elementary point that although the millionaires are paying, in a sense, no taxes to the Treasury, the price they have paid to avoid their taxes is to reduce the yield on their assets. You don't get away with paying when you're at, apart from outright evasion. The legal tax avoidance is possible only at a price. Now, this isn't to say that perhaps one might not want to hit these people harder, but if that is what one wants to do, it's a matter to face up to. Part of the issue really is, I think, that we have always wanted to pretend that the tax rates were much more progressive than they really were. The loopholes that people are through which high incomes escape taxation are loopholes that are built in as part of a very complicated political trade-off. So that legislators can get credit for imposing tax structures that look a good deal more progressive than they really want them to be. And the consequence is that every so often you hear lately, a good deal of the time, you hear loud outcries about millionaires not paying any taxes. The point of these remarks is simply that that taxation upon ability to pay is taxation that is going to cause diversion of resources. How much diversion is, frankly, a matter of great debate among economists, and I would be very reckless if I were to tell you that there's a lot, there will be that the effect of tax avoidance or attempted tax avoidance is great or is small. The direction of the effect, I don't think, is disputed. A tax on earned income leads to a reduction of earnings or effort directed to earnings. It leads to more time being spent within the household. It discourages division of labor and specialization, encouraging people to work within their household, not for exchange, to avoid doing things for the market. This may or may not be desirable, but it certainly has the effect of reducing the efficiency, the gains in efficiency that are connected with division of labor and specialization and exchange. If you say, well, let's find another kind of tax that doesn't do this. Let's have a tax, let's say, upon capacity. Make the people who are highly educated pay more. Well, people will then avoid education. They'll try and get the training without getting a label. If If you tax good grades, people will accordingly reduce their efforts to get good grades and try and learn anyway. If you try to tax windows, people do without them, as they once did in England. There is a long history of the consequences of misguided attempts to tax people upon external characteristics that are indicative of their wealth. Now, all of this is not really a plea, and it can't be, to have no taxation. Clearly, government, if only through its defense activities, needs fairly substantial amounts of revenue. Whether it needs revenue in the size that it now gets is another matter. But certainly there is going to be taxation. It's going to be taxation that one way or another is going to bear upon capacity, upon the utilization of productive capacity. It can be taxation, I think it can be taxation, that makes the distribution of measured income more equal. And if that's what you want and you're prepared to pay the price for it in reduced efficiency, a price that I don't think any of us is easily able to assess, I think then this is a possible course of public policy. It is not one, frankly, that I approve of, but it's a possible course. And I think we waste our time if we try to say attempts to equalize the distribution of income are bound to be self-defeating. They are bound to be costly. But if people are sufficiently determined to equalize the distribution of measured income, I think they can do it. Or not completely equal, but make it more equal than it otherwise has been. I don't want to be interpreted as saying that you can't do something about the distribution of income by taxation. However, I would also urge that the national income is not a piece of putty. You can't just cut it up any way you want to get shares in the shape you like without affecting the size of that putty pie. It will affect it, and it will affect it to an unspecifiable extent, and in ways that are not altogether fully predictable. What you can predict is that it will discourage effort. It will discourage the utilization of resources to produce things for the benefit, for exchange, for the benefit of other people, and encourage people to use their capacities to satisfy themselves and the other members of their household. Now, one effect or one purpose of income taxation is really to increase the importance of non-pecuniary, or loosely speaking, psychic income relative to market or pecuniary income. Let me read you part of a paper that I have here. Absent the measuring rod of money, A, individual A, might be superior to B as a carpenter, but B might be superior to A as a gardener. And the idea of overall superiority of A compared with B would be a kind of nebulous and unnatural idea. Indeed, once we get away from market evaluations, the relative merits of A and B are kind of difficult to appraise at all. And it's fairly easy to avoid ranking A and B. In a way, the trouble with market valuations, one reason why they're so unpopular, is that they make comparable all things that are saleable. The fact that the productive contributions of most individuals are comparable only in terms of pecuniary magnitudes creates a strong association between pecuniary evaluation of performance and economic inequality. I think much recurrent intellectual complaint about the injustice of the existing distribution of income is at bottom a protest against market valuation of output. Notoriously, the greatest pecuniary rewards don't go to the artists, musicians, writers, and so on, who are esteemed by the cognoscenti, but to those who satisfy popular taste. Understandably, this engenders disbelief among the upholders of extra market criteria of valuation in the association of market valuation of performance with skill and effort. The intellectual who feels his work to be undervalued by the market is obviously receptive to suggestions that economic success depends more on luck, influence, and most of all, willingness to sacrifice artistic or intellectual integrity to cater to uninformed taste. The confounding of genuine conflict of market and extra market values with self-serving deceptions concerning personal capacity makes this belief both tenacious and difficult to combat. Rejection of market valuations as a basis for income distribution leads to two very different attitudes that are often confused. One, deprecation of market-oriented activities, and two, deprecation of excellence itself. An income tax is well designed to discourage production for the market. By diverting effort from serving markets, it frees time for cultivating a broader range of skills than would flourish in a market-oriented household. In this way, income taxes promote the cultivation of more rounded, broadly skilled, and less, quotes, alienated individuals. In short, discouraging money-making reduces the prestige and importance of money-making specialists and expands that of individuals with other characteristics. But this doesn't obviously reduce inequality, and frankly, it isn't always intended to. Even the most cursory acquaintance with market-hostile intellectuals will serve to convince one that many of them do not have a pervasively egalitarian set of values. Their contempt for money-grubbing notwithstanding, they pursue honors, titles, and rank no less avidly than others. Indeed, one could explain a good deal of their behavior on the hypothesis that they feel they would do relatively better if rewards were handed out by prize committees instead of by the market. Their attitude is beautifully captured in a remark of George Bernard Shaw that I remember, but I haven't been able to find the citation. Of course, income should be distributed equally. After all, nothing else is. But not all who are hostile to market institutions desire only to substitute some other measure of achievement for money. There are genuine egalitarians, levelers, who would obliterate every basis of preferment among individuals. Whether it's possible to eliminate differences in lifetime utility among individuals depends critically upon their differences in innate capacity. If there were no differences in capacity of individuals at birth, conceivably, equality of achievement might be achieved by rigorous equalization of capacity created during childhood. However, to accomplish this, variation in child rearing would have to be carefully controlled. This would be, I think, in keeping with the spirit of the teachings of Chairman Mao, but whether it would create a reasonably close approach to equality at age 21 is a moot point, as I tried to point out earlier. I take it that the goal of radical egalitarians is the creation of a society in which it's impossible to rank individuals unambiguously on a scale of merit. In such a society, if A were superior to B in respect of characteristic X, B would be superior in respect of Y, but you couldn't aggregate them into an overall scale Z. What you want is a society in which there is no overall scale, then you really have to discourage market activities that permit that. But if you did that, what would happen to excellence? Excellence of any kind. If you really want to keep people equal, that means you've got to do something. You've got to stop them from having contests of various kinds. You can't have winners and losers and strivers and resenters. You've got to stop all that. Now, if that's what you're going to do, painters and so on, one possible answer is, who needs them? So you'll have people. So you won't have any, and you won't have any hyphenses playing the violin. And in particular, or if you have them, they'll be developed solely to please themselves and their families and the neighbors, and the rest of us will never hear. But more of us will be playing the violin for one another. There'll be less specialization. Everybody will be doing more of his own gardening, more of his own violin playing. I submit that if you did this, you wouldn't get the hyphenses. What makes it possible to get this degree of excellence is a great deal of concentration of effort, which has to be rewarded in fame, if not in money, and which does require large scale concerts, records, and so on. If there is not to be the possibility of organizing through scale, I don't think you will ever get people working hard enough, neurotically hard enough, if you like, to achieve the level of excellence that we really prize. If anyone says, this isn't worth it, I don't know what the real answer is. And I think some genuine egalitarians are prepared to sacrifice excellence of all kinds in order to get equality. And I think that's the price that would have to be paid. I would say this is not in accordance with my values, but I think it is an issue that those who are concerned with either preventing or encouraging genuine overall equality have to face. Merely equalizing the distribution of money income isn't going to get what a radical egalitarian wants. Real equality of feeling among people. To avoid the feeling that some have succeeded more than others. If that's what you want, I think you ultimately must strike at the root of excellence itself. And bear in mind what to me is perhaps the ultimate horror. If you succeeded, what then is left to lead to preferment of individuals, one among others? Why do I prefer A to associate with is against B? If all the ordinary criteria of excellence are to be eliminated, all that is left is physical strength and beauty. Ultimately, the attack on excellence is, from the economist's point of view, an attack on attempts to substitute effort and intellect for natural endowments of strength, beauty, sex appeal that's associated with them, and so on. I don't think ultimately you will really create equality. What you will do is simply make effort and attempts to persevere and to develop aspects of one's personality other than the kind of most primitive physical things, though you'll just simply eliminate the attempt to achieve those things, unless you're prepared to go still further and try and obliterate differences in people, physical differences, which may be indeed possible someday. If you want equality, perhaps we can get an equal opportunity creator who will just simply grind out so many identical sperms and put them into identical eggs, and we will have identical people who will indeed be equal. There'll be a loss of variety. I'm afraid I'm beginning to run out of time. Let me raise one, to me, fundamental problem for essentially egalitarians, and I think it's a problem for anti-egalitarians too. Most people who want to achieve a more equal distribution of income, because not many people really want complete equality, usually talk in terms of equalizing the distribution of income within a national boundary. It isn't ironical that that great egalitarian, Cesar Chavez, should be militantly engaged, should be engaged, and quite militantly so, in demanding that people now resident in Mexico be restricted or prevented from coming to the United States to sell their labor services. Similarly, in many European countries, socialist egalitarians are very anxious to restrict, sometimes to stop altogether, migration of people from one country to another, because the migrants would lower the wages and the incomes of those worst off within the country, and thereby widen the inequality, increase the inequality within the country. The greatest differences, after all, in the distribution of income within the world are between countries, not within countries. The greatest monopoly on earth, as far as I know, is access to the American labor market. And this is possessed by American citizens and those able to get access to it. Now, I am far from saying simply and categorically, let us remove all income, all immigration barriers. Let there be a worldwide open society. To a libertarian, and I like to think of myself as one, this has a lot of appeal. On the other hand, the short-run consequences, I must say, are mildly disturbing. And this is, to me, an intellectual and to some extent a moral dilemma. Libertarianism, if practiced on an international scale, I think would have a very serious and important effect in reducing inequality in the distribution of earnings and incomes. It is fundamentally anti-national, and I think there would be no country in the world where we'd have a prayer politically, and I am not very sure how many people are prepared here and now to favor egalitarianism on an international scale. I don't know if I am. I know my libertarianism implies that I should. The thought of just what kinds of adjustment would be required in the next two decades if we were to do it, if we were to tell the people of Bangladesh, for example, come and not try to fudge and say, well, you've got to pay your own way and there's not going to be any credit for your passage, etc. Really tell them to come. And let anyone who wants to use their labor perhaps forward their passage money. That's what egalitarianism would imply. Most of the, I would say, the libertarians among us, the pseudo-egalitarians, I think for the most part can protect us from the consequences of our own ethics. The people who want to do something to equalize the distribution of income in the United States are not at all prepared to face up to this. In fact, the people whose interests would be most injured would be the people who are worst off within the United States, namely our own poor. It is no accident that Cesar Chavez is opposed to letting poorer Mexicans come into the United States to reduce the incomes of less poor Mexicans who have been here a while. All the same, I think that I would hope that some of our discussion can concentrate on this basic problem, which to me is an unsolved one and not one that I think will be solved very quickly. Well, now I think I've already used up enough of the time and with the speech, and perhaps you'd better get on with the discussion.